You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, everyone. I'm Andy Gibson. I'm founder and head gardener of the public mental health campaign Mind Apples and also a trustee here at the RSA. And I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's debate here in the RSA in London, and for all of our subscribers to the live broadcast and podcast, welcome back to our ongoing conversation, which tonight turns once again to spirituality. This is the last event in our series exploring the relevance of spirituality to our lives. Is spirituality a relic of a more superstitious age or something vital to how we live today? Something that can lift us beyond our subjective search for happiness and give meaning to our suffering, connect us to something larger than ourselves, and make sense of our fear and trembling. The final findings from our work on this theme will be published soon, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the team and all the contributors and to our funders, the Touchstone Trust and the Templeton Foundation, for the faith that they have shown by backing this very interesting and thoughtful project. And it really is an act of faith to embark upon a project like this, a long-term study of something that is not necessarily the thing that everybody has been talking about, but actually is something that people increasingly are turning back to, that we feel very proud to have been associated with this research. And faith is perhaps a good word to consider in the context of tonight's conversation. To describe oneself as a person of faith implies a religious belief, but actually we all have faith to some degree. As a trustee here, I have faith in the work done by my colleagues, and the RSA has faith that by researching a subject like spirituality, we will yield fresh insights and perspectives on how we live. And we are grateful for the faith shown in our work by the 27,000 fellows that whose ongoing support allows us to explore these unusual topics together. We all have faith in something. Our partners, our friends, our colleagues, the doctors and nurses that care for us, the institutions that govern us, perhaps. Next year, we will see our politicians asking us to have faith in their abilities to lead us into a new decade, and from your faith that the chair beneath you will support you throughout the next hour, to my faith that my colleagues have given me accurate notes on who is speaking tonight. Perhaps the question is not whether to have faith, but how to choose where to put the faith that we all have. And we're very pleased to welcome our fine panel for this evening to discuss this and many other questions of love, death, self, and soul. Professor Andrew Samuels is a psychotherapist, author, political consultant, and activist who has written about spirituality, most notably in his book Politics on the Couch, Citizenship and the Internal Life. Claire Foster Gilbert is founder and director of the Westminster Abbey Institute, which aims to revitalize moral and spiritual values in public life. Marina Benjamin is an author and journalist and a senior editor at Eon Magazine. And we'll begin by hearing from Dr. Jonathan Rowson, who is leading the Spirituality, Tools of the Mind and Social Brain project here at the RSA. And after degrees from Oxford and Harvard, Jonathan's doctoral research was an examination of the concept of wisdom. And he is an author of a number of books relating to his former life, which many people don't know he has, as a 3-times British chess champion and grand master. So he's clever, basically. And Jonathan will be reflecting on the key findings from our ambitious programme of public inquiry and debate and offering his take on how we might create a more substantial and grounded public role for the spiritual in a post-religious or perhaps post-Christian society. Jonathan will be chairing questions from you all later, which I hope you will join us in asking, including on Twitter. Please welcome tonight's panel, and I, for one, have faith that the conversation will be a rewarding one. Welcome, Jonathan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Welcome back. I feel as though I know about a third of you from looking around, so I'm very glad that you've stayed with us. I have this written down, but I'm actually not going to refer to it. It helped me to make sense of what I want to say, but I realised tonight that really it's fairly simple what I want to say. There are 4 main parts to it. The first part is about the context, the nature of the spiritual, the definition, the relevance of it. The second part is about understanding the sort of roots of it in our understanding of ourselves and the new science that's making sense of why the spiritual might be particularly important to understand. And then there's the issue of the sort of full flowering of the spiritual in what I'm calling love, death, self, and soul, which I believe are the sort of 4 touchstones for the conversation we need to have. And then finally, there's the kind of so what question. There's the kind of what does this all mean? What do we do with it? And as I was walking here tonight over Waterloo Bridge, I suddenly realized that, you know, it's kind of the first night of winter in some ways. You felt this nip in the air, this kind of chill. And I thought that one way of thinking of this journey of these four points is really like a seasonal way, that actually you begin with the spiritual in a kind of winter, because where we are culturally is that we don't really have a clue what we're talking about when we say spiritual. Even after 2 years, we really struggle to make something like the spiritual feel less nebulous, less contentious, less personal, less fissiparous is my favorite word, tending to fly off in different directions. And so you look at the tree in winter and you see there's nothing on it. There's no kind of leaves. It's not full. You sense there's something there that's important, but you feel as though, you know, something's missing. We ought to have leaves there. We ought to have something fuller. And in that context, the project came in. It was trying to make sense of what's going on there. We have this felt sense that the spiritual matters to us, but how do we articulate it? How do we give it, first of all, intellectual grounding, and secondly, sort of public relevance? And we've done this with about 300 people. I've been sort of leading it and trying to drive it forward. But we've invited a lot of people to workshops. We had a student design award competition. And throughout that, I've realized there are certain key pitfalls to avoid. One is the status claim of spirituality. Be careful that when you say spiritual, you're not helping yourself to a kind of honorific. You're not helping yourself to prestige. Just because something is spiritual, it doesn't follow that it's necessarily good. Also, be careful of the relationship to religion, the relationship to well-being, and to some extent, the relationship to politics. All of these relationships you have to sort of manage carefully. But throughout that time, the main thing I felt is when you're talking of the spiritual, it does very strange things to people's facial expressions. So I've noticed over time that just from the beginning of a conversation, there are broadly three archetypal responses. The first response is what I call the spiritually promiscuous response. That's the response of people who look you in the eye, but a little bit too keenly, a little bit too eagerly. And you feel as though no matter what you say about the spiritual, they're going to love it. They just want the spiritual, no matter what it is, bring it on. So whether it's meditation, you know, I'll be there at church, well, I hear they have good wine, you know, psychedelics, I'll try anything once. You know, just spiritual was unambiguously a good thing, but no real discrimination, no sense of boundary. The second was the kind of what I call the religious diplomats. These are the people who tend to be quite warm, but also a little bit wary. They're very keen on what you're doing and very curious. But they can't quite figure out whether you're one of them, trying to sort of validate and sort of reinforce their place in the world, or whether you're actually trying to supplant them somehow, whether actually your role is to destroy religion and sort of topple it with this new, you know, insurrection of spirituality. And finally, though, the one that worries me most is the intellectual assassins. The intellectual assassins look at you with a kind of disdain and disgust. They look at you and go, spirituality? What kind of nebulous nonsense is this? You know, complete crap. Spirituality, like it's thin, it doesn't make any sense, it has no roots. You don't know what you're talking about. And these three have been there throughout. Some of you might even be in the audience. Think of which one you are. But actually, the psychotherapist in the room will know these are all projections. You know, these are all things that I've been wrestling with. I've been dabbling in New Age bookshops. I've gone back to church, you know, trying to belong again. I've meditated more than many and, you know, looking for some sort of insider peace but not always finding it. And I've also find that the hardest thing I found is that articulating this search is not just a personal thing. What I've been trying to do with the spiritual is make it public again, because the tragedy, I think, is that when we associate the spiritual only with those New Age, spiritual but not religious tendencies, we lose the best of it. We've outsourced the deep psychological, social, cultural resources of the spiritual to what often looks like a kind of crypto-capitalist project to sell more stuff, to flog people experiences and products, to prop up a sense of identity that's not altogether healthy. So there are aspects of the spiritual that I don't like. Likewise with religion, there's a kind of sense of, you know, it's not very mature to completely reject it. It doesn't feel like spiritual but not religious. Never sounded to me like it rang true. As if you could completely sever the spiritual from the places in history and the institutions and the people and the practices and the doctrine that has been trying to make sense of the spiritual for, you know, decades, centuries, millennia. And then finally, the issue of how we deal with this publicly is particularly important when it comes to intellectual assassins, because they're the ones that prevent you talking about it in public. In a sense, you want to be able to speak of this on Question Time. You want to be able to speak of this on Thought for the Day, as we do, but also on, you know, the main news story on the Today program. You want to say that, look, the stuff you're speaking about, rising interest rates, economic growth, it's all very well, but it's not where my heart is. It's not the heart of what our lives are about. Where are those conversations? You know, that was the problem. So the intellectual assassins get in the way because you actually need to be able to speak of this in a way that, to some extent, appeases them with a sort of grounded notion of the spiritual that people can buy into. So that's where I was. It's trying to make sense of these diverse influences. And that's the kind of winter, but the winter is sort of a coming spring. So the sort of the roots of the spring come from, I think, as the ground thaws, if you'll bear with me in this metaphor, as the ground thaws, you begin to get a better feeling for these roots. And you look into those roots, and one of the best ways of looking at those roots are, the spiritual's broadly three questions, I think. It's, what are we? You know, how should we live? And why are we here? You know, now the why are we here is a tough metaphysical one that's somewhat beyond what we can answer definitively. And the how we should live is an ethical question that stays with us. But the what are we actually we're getting somewhere with? We're actually beginning to understand who we are better, not just from third-person scientific perspectives, but also from first-person perspectives. And most of the third-person scientific views are actually corroborated by our own experience. And I'm going to mention four quickly. The first is we're on autopilot virtually all of the time. We don't speak enough about this, but you know, you can take spurious statistics about the percentage of time, but most of the time, we're actually in a kind of stupor where we're not really sure what we're doing. And we occasionally snap out of it and become conscious. But when you start doing even a tiny bit of meditation, this becomes abundantly clear, that we're actually on autopilot most of the time. And that matters because when people say wake up, the spiritual injunction to wake up is grounded in an increasingly sophisticated scientific understanding of the fact that we're not only creatures of habit, but habit-forming creatures. We actually live and function socially and adaptively by making habits for ourselves so that we have to think as little as possible. So we're actually built almost to put ourselves to sleep. And the spiritual injunction there is, well, look, if that's the case, if that's what science tells us and that's what we see in our own experience, waking up makes a lot of sense. And we can speak of that with intellectual confidence. The second is grounded in the work of Ian McGilchrist, which I think needs to be better known, and I've done work with him in the past trying to bring that to public attention. The work is on the hemispheres of the brain, and it's not the classic pop psychology of left and right that says left is creative and right is creative and left is somehow logical. It's not that at all. It's that when you look more deeply at the science, you find that we actually live in two different worlds most of the time. We have two different forms of perception in our minds that consciousness plays a kind of trick on us and tells us it's coherent in one thing. But actually, we very much have two ways of being. And one way of being is very analytical and precise in breaking things down and stripping them of context. And the other is much more holistic and particular and grounded in the sort of broader holistic context of things. And the problem we have is that much of our culture, Ian argues, is moving towards this very fragmented obsession with measurement, obsession with precision. And that matters because, you know, the better part of us is struggling to be heard in public life. And most of us, I think, can sense that. The part of us that wants to speak of more emotional, soulful, spiritual things struggles to be heard because it's up against this very analytical, slicing and dicing kind of mentality. And again, that's grounded in the science, in the roots of who we are. Thirdly, and it won't surprise you to hear this, we live in our bodies. But that matters much more than we typically think. You begin to meditate and you discover very, very fast there's an awful lot going on in your body that you have no idea about. Your body is hugely awake and alive with things going on if you know how to interrogate it. But not just that. Almost all of spiritual experience, any kind of transcendence, any kind of sense of oneness and wholeness begins in the body. When Guy Claxton was on this stage a few months back, he said religious edifices are built out of bodily experiences and sensations. And also the body is what we play with. You know, Pat Kane writes about the play ethic rather than the work ethic because we're a society that's losing touch with the sensuality and soulfulness of playing. But the play comes through the limbs and the eyes and the mouth and the voice. There's more about the body, but the other thing that you need to know about is, you know, we live with other people. Again, hardly a revelation. But the science, again, is giving a much more sophisticated picture of what it means to live with other people. We evolve through and for relationships with others. And what that means spiritually, I think, is that the notion of spiritual is an entirely individualistic endeavor. The way it's often critiqued as all that stuff, the critique from religion is typically there's no community, there's no commitment, you're just kind of out on your own trying to do your own spiritual thing. misses the point that any meaningful spiritual development will come through relationships. Often relationships with teachers or mentors, sometimes relationships with peers, sometimes relationships with spouses or children. But spiritual development has to be grounded in that kind of psychological rootedness of relationships, or it's not really going to work. John Wellwood speaks of spiritual bypassing in that regard. People have a sort of shaky sense of self and they shore it up with going on retreat, but actually they often need to look more deeply at their relationships. So these four things are there, these four roots in spring, that I think actually help you understand what the tree is. They help you understand that actually the spiritual has real roots in human nature that are grounded in science, but are also available to us experientially. We can come to know them. And we move into summer. We move into summer with, I think, the full flowering of that understanding. And I think we discover the things that matter to us are not what we previously thought mattered to us. Our place in the world matters less than our ground. Our status, our personality, our identity matters less than this sense of being alive, this deep sense of gratitude we have for being here. And I call it love, self, love, death, self, and soul for the following reason. Love, I think, is widely used in popular culture, but typically as a form of desire and attraction and romance, which is fine. They're all good things. You know, there's no knocking that. But on the other hand, that's not all love is. Love, I think, properly understood, and I think I'm thinking of the work of Professor Simon May in particular here, is grounded in what he calls ontological rootedness. Love is that which we seek. It gives us the promise of belonging in the world. And that's what we love. We love the things that help us feel at home here. And when you think of when you well up, think of those moments where you suddenly find your quivering lip is there, and you feel as though somehow what's about to happen is really significant, but you can't quite articulate it. For me, that's partly the experience of love, of trying to find your home in the world. And that's what makes you well up. Death. We spoke about this a few months back here as well. We tend to avoid death. We avoid it. We are anxious of it. We don't look at it. But all of us will die. And we don't really face up to that. And yet the curious fact is, those who have a near-death experience report a much richer, fuller life afterwards. They say that, you know, post-traumatic growth that follows from surviving cancer or a serious accident, people tend to have a complete reorientation in their lives as a result. What does that mean, given that we know we're going to die already? It means death has to be a bigger part of the public conversation, facing up to the fact that our time is finite and not to waste it. Self and soul, to some people, seem very similar, but I deliberately separate them because I think culturally we struggle to understand what they're both pointing towards. The self is actually quite problematic, I think. The self, when you look at it, is when you begin to slow down, you see that you're chattering all the time in your own mind, trying to shore up a sense of personality and identity that actually is quite flimsy. There's a lovely saying by a Taoist, British Taoist, and there aren't many of them. He says, why are you unhappy? He said, it's because 99.9% of everything you think and say and do is for yourself, and there isn't one. And similarly, in popular culture, rather than British Taoism, you know, Tracy Chapman sings All That You Have Is Your Soul. And it's a kind of lovely little charming song, but there's a sort of deep truth in that, that we've kind of neglected the soul. The soul, whereas culturally the self has been revered and celebrated, the soul has been somewhat forgotten about because of a materialist mindset that says if it's not a thing, if it doesn't have an ontology that places it inside you as a real entity, it doesn't exist anymore. But much of what we're learning is that, you know, we can't really do without the concept of the soul. We need this perspective of the whole. We need this perspective of reaching beyond and grasping and looking for something slightly beyond our reach. The soul gives us that in a way that nothing else quite can. And when Ian McGilchrist spoke here, he spoke of that very eloquently. And it's not easy to bring back the soul into public language, but we all kind of feel it. We know the soul when we see it. And we need to work a bit harder to speak more confidently about it. So that's what I see as kind of summer. The full flowering is, these four things are not just descriptive metaphors, they're all injunctions in their own way. The issue is to love more fully and deeply, to know what you love and why, to confront your death, to realize you will die and live differently as a result, to know yourself more deeply and see that something that needs to be transcended, to integrated to some extent through relationships, but also transcended. The self is something that may not be fully real and we need to come to realize that. The soul is something we need to know more deeply, often through arts, often through richer forms of inquiry as we create and so forth. So these injunctions are there, and it brings us to kind of winter. You get to this picture of, well, Where are we? You know, we have this redescription. It's kind of cartography, redescribing things. But most of the time in this project, when something happened that was meaningful, it was a very deep felt sense. You would sometimes find yourself really hanging on a word. And it was usually when people spoke from personal experience. It was usually when people said, you know, I find myself kind of really, really focusing intensely on what they were trying to say. And when they're speaking deeply, so when Elizabeth Oldfield of Theos spoke about her experience of prayer, when the mayor of Vancouver, Sam Sullivan, spoke about his accident as he became a paraplegic for life and had a spiritual experience where he realized that he shouldn't give up on his life, but he could make use of what he had left for public service. These moments where people really get to the heart of what they're doing is the moments we wake up. So for me, what I want to say is, you know, the spiritual is worth fighting for. You know, it is a bit unclear. It always will be. But don't let the fact that it's unclear and contested and lacking institutional roots and clear tradition, don't let that stop us talking of the things that matter most to in our lives. So when we come to autumn and the tree is shedding its leaves, the question is really, how does the cycle begin again? We get to the end of this project and we have certain ideas about, in the report which will come out in December, some ideas about what this means for public policy. And public policy, by that we don't mean some technocrats in Whitehall. We mean how do we remobilize people, the democratic reawakening that we kind of need. And on that note, on my personal front, my most spiritual experience of the last few months was not some sort of divine revelation. It was campaigning for a yes vote in Scotland. Now, I say that knowing that the politics is very charged, but I say it advisedly because many people have reported this sense of enormous aliveness and fullness their lives suddenly had for those months. Now, the politics is one question, and I'll leave that to one side. But what we saw there is a deep longing to sort of reconnect with roots. There may be all sorts of self-serving arguments and imagined futures that are questionable and doubtful premises and so forth. But people sort of re-sense this belonging. So the way I would frame the spiritual there is there's the kind of being. There's the kind of being that comes from death. There's the belonging that comes from love. There's the becoming that comes from the self. And there's the beyondness that comes from the soul. And I think my experience of that political action, of campaigning for something I believed in, was that suddenly all these things were mobilized. And the point is, it doesn't have to be that cause. You know, that was my cause at that time. But finding a cause like that, where you can align those different aspects of your life in a deep-rooted way that connects you with other people, that, I think, is the kind of thing we have to look for in the spiritual. The spiritual that's grounded in the self and your deepest longings, connected to your roots, but also looking for something bigger in the world. And that's what I'd like to leave the others to talk about as we imagine the autumn leaves falling. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jonathan. So we ditched the notes. I'm Claire Foster-Gilbert. I'm founder director of Westminster Abbey Institute. So just imagine, or remember perhaps, Parliament Square here in the heart of London. You have on one side Westminster Abbey. It's been there for 1,000 years. Some monks arrived in 960, Benedictine monks. One of them had a vision of St. Peter, and he said, we'll lay our foundation here, and they did in 960. There are some rather fancy Waterford crystal chandeliers hanging in the Abbey, which were a gift from the Guinness family, for its 1,000th birthday in 1960. It's been there for a while, on one side of the square, Westminster Abbey. Now that the Supreme Court has come out of the House of Lords, it is housed in what used to be Middlesex County Court on the to the left of the Abbey. So here we have the judiciary, Westminster Abbey, the judiciary. Opposite Westminster Abbey is the Treasury and all of Whitehall, the Executive. And then to the right of the Abbey is Parliament, the Legislature. So here you have, and I guess it's unique in the world probably, on Constitution Square, the Legislature, the Judiciary, the Executive, and this bloody great church. And the Institute, Westminster Abbey Institute, which was only launched last year, is really an answer to the question, what's the Abbey bringing to public life? And I guess we'll be trying to answer that question, I hope, for 1,000 years. It'll stay a live question. But clearly, the nature of the answers that it's going to give, or the nature of the conversations that it's going to bring to public life and public service, are going to be in the sort of realms that Jonathan's been describing. So I say, fantastic that this is coming out and speaking. And it is the most extraordinary privilege to be there in the Abbey with this opportunity to speak out loud. And it's not surprising to speak about these things in Westminster Abbey, because, after all, that's the sort of place that it is. What I have been absolutely overwhelmed and amazed by is the response from people around the square. It's like a brittle sponge that is so desperate for water. It's like a physiological response. I feel sucked dry by something, and it's obviously the people, but it's the institutions. It's in the air, this huge longing for depth, for the chance to think about what it is we're trying to do as public servants. What is the good of us being here? What are we trying to do? Nobody understands us. Nobody understands that we're trying to be good. We MPs, we members of the House of Lords, we civil servants, the Supreme Court judges don't worry too much about that. Nevertheless, they come to things. They're massive supporters, and I am a bit overwhelmed by it, by this hunger, deep hunger. And let me tell you, if I didn't have 1,000 years of Benedictine spirituality to draw on, I would be nothing. I simply couldn't do it. So what I really want to say is, don't give up on the old religions. We need them. We need their story. We need their history. We need all the mistakes that they've made over the millennia, all the recognitions of the dangers of spirituality. My God, is it dangerous, spirituality, once let loose? And I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. But don't give up on it, because that is where the resource is. Not just Christianity, that's my tradition, but mosque in Regent's Park. There's such a wise, intelligent, thoughtful, joyful imam there. Go to the West London synagogue and listen to some Jews arguing. Or go to Bevis Marks and hear the outpouring of praise for God. Or go to the most incredible, enormous Sikh Gurdwara in Birmingham and listen to a priestess speak with such wisdom about the truths of the universe. It's all there, you know. It's all there. And we need to go back to it with this new understanding, which is so fantastic and so challenging and so awakening, and get going with what's there. Get going with what's there. The other reason I make this plea, and I guess it is a plea, is my own story. I was born into a new religious movement, a sort of tamish cult. and I saw from first hand how spirituality, when, as it were, taken into human's own hands, can become such a force for imprisonment and have such arrogance. So this new religious movement, which was founded, like quite a few, after the Second World War, in response to this wrenching experience and this deep desire that people had to feel something more spiritual than it felt the dear old Church of England was giving, with its Sunday services, which hadn't changed, it felt. There was no depth there. People looked east, basically, and the Maharishi helped and the Beatles helped, and that's what my new religious movement did. And I'm sure the person who founded it did not intend this when he started, but he became a guru. He became a leader. You're sounding a little bit like a guru, Jonathan. Be careful. Because people will follow you. People want somebody to be the Messiah. This happened to me, actually. I was getting a bit, giving a talk in this new religious movement, getting a bit passionate, and afterwards someone came up to me and said, "You're the one." She meant it. And I looked into her eyes. Fuck. And then I thought, sorry, I'm looking at you, because it was very personal. And maybe you are. No, and I thought, what I saw was, she wanted me to be the one so she didn't have to be. Please, be my leader, be my teacher. Sanderson, this fantastic guy, looks a bit like Tom Cruise in that film about cults, runs the Sunday Assembly. He looks like a guru, poor love, and these hundreds of people are coming, they're dying for something, and he's giving it to them, and he's so charismatic, and I know he doesn't want power and all that blah which this leader of my new religious movement ended up having. But it's happening, and people are asking him to marry them now. You know, we're making new religions. Why not go to the old ones where all the mistakes, as I say, have been made? And this leader of this new religious movement I was in became that infallible person. And I think he looked at his followers and thought, well, I can't let you down. You want to be devoted to me. Devotion is a lovely, wonderful thing. So, all right, be devoted to me. But it was very, very unhealthy. And I was in that for some 30 years, and as a child when you kind of didn't know what was happening. And then I thought, this makes sense, and I stayed. For those of you who know, it was in the Advaita tradition, so non-duality. I stayed and became a tutor and nearly got turned into a guru. Someone offered me 1,600 followers once. So clearly I should start it, or could start a cult. And then it started to bite. I felt I wasn't going to achieve full self-realization, which had been promised. I looked at the 60-year-olds and thought, no, you haven't. What reason might I think for me doing the same? And then I discovered a course on the roots of Christian mysticism, which I went on, and to my surprise, because new religious movements think that religions don't know anything about meditation or depth or spirituality. And there it all was, you know, from the Gospels onwards in this case, and of course it's earlier than the Gospels. There was that mystic tradition. And there, of course, is also the active tradition. So if your temperament is to go deep, it's there. If your temperament is to be activist, it's there. And you can move from one to the other. It's all there, you know. So bring that inspiration, that understanding, the greater, the better understanding we have now of who we are to the religions that we have. Thank you very much.
I'm a psychotherapist, a Jungian analyst, and I work with politicians, political parties, and more activist organisations. It's not surprising, then, that I would write and think about spirituality in the political and public spheres, and above all, given the topic this evening, how the spiritual can inform, and by the way, be informed by, public policy formation. It's a two-way thing, and I'll return to that at the end. I don't like a kind of dominant place given to anything, neither to psychology, nor to spirituality, nor to government. In the book that was mentioned, 2001, Politics on the Couch, I called for a National Institute for Reconciliation, and relevant for this evening, I called for an Emotional and Spiritual Justice Commission. Well, it won't have escaped your attention that these things didn't happen. But part of a tricksterish approach to politics is that if you're coming from out of left field in both senses, you have to try to speak the language that the politicians and the civil service understand. So a spiritual and emotional, an emotional and spiritual justice commission was a neat idea in which to encapsulate matters and themes that had very little to do with a conventional approach to justice. 2001, it feels a long time ago. The French writer on culture, Charles Péguy, said everything starts in mysticism and ends in politics. We can adapt. Everything starts in spirituality and ends in politics. And what is so important is the recognition that spirituality is not an inner private thing, but an outer public thing as well. Now, it's traditional for psychotherapists to tell audiences like you what they are learning from their clients, as if their clients are the canaries in the cages down the mine and paying for the privilege of being so. What the clients know is that there's a two-way street between personal transformation and social transformation. There is absolutely no point in sorting out the emotional and relationship problems of an individual, clarifying their issues via an analysis of their dreams, working on the intricacies of the intersubjective relationship between the client and the therapist, if after every session and at the end of the therapy, The client has to go out into the same fucking awful mess out there in society that was there before they came into therapy. But at the same time, what we now know, and it's recognized by a meeting and a series like this, is that if you change only the material conditions, if you change only the constitutional and legal frameworks, then you can't refresh the parts that the spiritual bit can refresh. You have to do both. One isn't more important than the other. Becoming individuated is not more important than the revolution, and vice versa. So what do we need? We need what I've called a new anatomy of spirituality, and I'll talk about it in a second. But what we need to do is recognize that we don't have to invent spirituality. We don't have to strive towards it. If we know how to look, it's ubiquitous. It's every day. It's even boring. It's hidden in the open. The anatomy of spirituality that I developed and have been thinking about for years now had three aspects to it that are relevant to this ubiquitous, everyday spirituality of use in the public sphere, in the public conversation, that you don't have to create, you only have to locate. Social spirituality, democratic spirituality, and craft spirituality. Let me explain. And I'm going to refer to some of the things that Jonathan said, because we are supposed to refer to some of the things that Jonathan said. But in fact, he didn't say what I thought he was going to say, but so much the better, as you will see. No, it's important. When people's ideas coalesce, is a great moment. Social spirituality works like this. It's to do with people coming together in the social sphere to do something. It could be a big something, like CND. It could be a little something, like fight against the bypass. It could be highly personal, to do with a particular disease or illness that the individuals concerned are engaged with. Whatever. What it isn't is spiritual people coming together in the social. People come together in the social, and if they do so in a full-blooded way, including differences of opinion, then a kind of rain descends that turns an ordinary activity, signing a petition, going on a demo, that gets changed. You've all had these experiences, into something spiritual. That's social spirituality. What comes with belonging to a group that has a goal. And there's a responsibility element in that too, because the individuals have to think about where they stand in relation to the issues, as well as where the group stands. That's social spirituality. And by the way, what's good about my anatomy is that it breaks up the monolith spirituality, because there's many spiritualities. The second one, you may recall, was democratic spirituality. Now, you talked about a democratic reawakening, and I think you were talking about it as a collective phenomenon, but it's also an individual phenomenon. What is democratic spirituality? For me, it is equality in the eyes of the Lord, broadly speaking. An ineluctable, fundamental equality, not an equality of outcome. So it's not something that you socially engineer fiscally. It's something that should inform public policy, but does not inform public policy these days under this government to a quite extraordinary degree. Democratic spirituality has been utterly banished. The idea of fundamental equality is not something to be left in the sermons of the rabbinate or the vicars or the imams or the priests. It's something that needs to be fought for. So in addition to social spirituality, that rain that qualitatively changes what a group of people do from being an ordinary thing into a spiritual thing needs to be added in with the idea that when you do it, there are no leaders, When you do it, everybody is equal. Of course, there are dimensions of this where there will be leaders and people are far from equal. But that's not the point here. The point here is that there is a value which you could tag as democratic spirituality, fundamental equality. You may recall the third one was craft spirituality, which has everything to do with work. We have lost, Marx was right, we have become alienated from work. And the solution, I fear, is not that everybody makes pots. Well, Grayson can make pots, but not everybody can deal with the deficit of craft spirituality by turning to craft. We have to have a discussion, we need to open the discussion about how to re-spiritualize the workplace. Do you remember the days of the worker priests? It would be quite interesting to see what might be recovered from that tradition. Well, that's my anatomy of spirituality. I could sit down, but I'm not going to, because there's bad news. The last part of this concerns the shadow of spirituality, which has been touched on, but what I'm going to say is a bit more systematic. For Jung, the shadow of an individual is the thing that person has no wish to be. The shadow of spirituality is everything that the spirit has no wish to be, but sadly is. Firstly, spiritual energy is not all left-wing, progressive, collaborative, cooperative, and so on. It is not all creative. It is not all good. Doesn't mean it's bad. It's neutral. The spirit is neutral. The important thing to realize is it can go terribly wrong. Look at Nazi meetings, rallies. It's up to us what we do with the spiritual energy. So the first thing to note about the shadow of spirituality is that the spirit, God too, depends on the human. What the human does with that spiritual energy is what is important, not the existence of a spiritual energy, which from a political point of view, I'm sorry to say, is neutral. Second problem with spirituality, second aspect of the shadow of spirituality, is its very poor relation to the body, something that you talked about. In my full anatomy of spirituality, in the book and elsewhere, I talk about profane spirituality, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and the spirituality to be found at present in experimental approaches to relationships such as thoughtful promiscuity and polyamory. This is where the spiritual is found at the moment in the bodily area, but too many accounts of spirituality omit the way in which the sexual body contributes to it. Anyone who's read theistic mystics will know that what they write about sounds very like sexual intercourse, and that's no accident. Another aspect of the shadow of spirituality is that it tends to the elitist and the esoteric. We are better than them, and this is actually inherited from the religions, I'm sorry to say. The elitist part is problematic, but the esoteric part is even worse. What I'm all about is an everyday, ordinary, even quite boring spirituality that would not be elitist and esoteric. We've heard already about tendencies towards cults and gurus and leaders, but the last thing to say is that there is still, in the shadow of spirituality, a desire to remain indifferent to and cut off from suffering in society. So the punchline here is this. Spirituality needs to change. It needs to have another agenda. It needs to be more relevant to the public conversation. It needs to be recognized as there for the making and the taking. Spirituality has to change, and politics has to change. But if we come out of this meeting thinking that what we're going to do is apply a dose of the spiritual to the political, then I fear we will merely make matters worse. Thank you.
I've never had a problem. I've never had a problem with either or, with this idea that either you're religious or you're secular. I think I've always felt I could feel quite comfortable somewhere in between. So I'm going to draw my responses partly from religion and partly from not religion. but I wanted to begin with a word about the term post-religious, which is that I think that one of the reasons why religions have survived down the millennia is because they are themselves post-religious. They change and they adapt to the circumstances that we find ourselves in as humans. We make them, we reshape them to our needs. They adapt in time. Christianity right now, just to take a very brief example, with the exception of pockets of creationist fundamentalism, for the last 150 years, Christianity, we've witnessed how it has slowly twisted itself into an accommodation with evolution. And before that, it shape-shifted again, this time to accommodate geological time. But the example that I want to spend a little bit more time on about how religions adapt and become something else entirely and yet still survive is drawn from a moment in history when Judaism was at its greatest, under its greatest threat. Judaism is generally known as a this-worldly religion, a faith that places its emphasis on its philosophy for living. And that is certainly what it has become in the centuries leading up to the Common Era. That's not at all what Judaism was. It was a deeply riven, deeply sectarian faith, so that even in its institutionalized forms, you had the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And outside of that, you had this kind of realm of apocalyptic ferment. You know, you had a conquered nation who were told that that they had a holy land, that it was theirs, that God was had chosen them. They were a chosen people, elected to be in this land, to have this place and this temple in Jerusalem. And repeatedly, they were a colonized people. They were a humiliated people. They were driven out into exile. And so they came up with this theology, this apocalyptic eschatology, which basically said, you know, you have an all-powerful God. Place your faith in me, and I will come and act, intervene in history, bash down mountains, dry up rivers, and restore you to your home. This was the faith of Isaiah. This is the faith that the Jews believed in. But it created messianic expectation. It created this idea that, you know, that somebody would announce that that they knew that when the restoration would happen, that they had the way, that if you only did this, if you only believed this, then we would have this national restoration. And so by the time you got up to the first century BC, you know, you had Jerusalem swarming with mystics and soothsayers and cults, and you had messianic candidates. Judas Maccabeus, for example, was a candidate in the second century BC when he stood up to the Seleucids. In the first century after Christ, you had Simon Bar Kokhba, another nationalist messiah of a acting in history, military, militant kind. But then you had two sects that were particularly challenging because they set themselves up in opposition not just to the enemies of the Jews, but to the Jews themselves. And the first sect I'm referring to are the Essenes. And I won't spend very much time talking about them because I want to wrap this example up quite quickly. And the second sect, of course, was the sect of Christians. And Christianity, of course, became, you know, the ultimate test of whether Judaism would survive, because here was messianism in action, not just quietist hope, but something that actually precipitated out of the faith into an alternative faith, something monstrous, something that told you that actually, if you had messianic hope, that, you know, that you were on the slippery slope to apostasy. So Judaism adapted. I mean, it just fundamentally changed. When the canon was made in the first century, practically every apocalyptic text was banished to the Apocrypha. It became a religion that said, basically, don't hope. It banished the eschatological horizon to the very distant future. It said, don't wait for the Messiah. Live in this world. Make this world the best world that you can make it. It focused on how to live. And this basic commitment to kind of creating, creative, dynamic change on Earth has sometimes, according to George Steiner anyway, itself been guilty of a kind of messianic hope. George Steiner famously quipped about Marxism, the origins of Marxism, that it arose not because the Messiah had been too long in coming, but that because the Messiah had been too long in not coming. But of course that banishment of mysticism from the canon didn't mean that it died altogether. There was a hunger for it, as there always is, and you have flourishing mystical traditions in the Kabbalah and so forth. But the lesson that I wanted to draw from that example today, was that however you conceive of the spiritual, you need to build in the idea that this conception must change. It must change by necessity, because we're not looking for timeless qualities. They don't last like Platonic goods or the Christian virtues, for example. I mean, there are things we can aspire to, but they don't sit in history, and I would argue that we need a spirituality that sits comfortably with history. And whatever Francis Fukuyama might argue, we still live inside history. We live with conflict, and more importantly, in some ways, we live with difference, more so in an era of globalization than ever before. I think we live in very opportune times. I think we live in times where there is a great deal of seeking, and that seeking is born out of this idea that we seem to be in a sort of phase of reaction to the grand projects that were born in the Enlightenment. There is reaction to the idea that reason has a primacy in ways of knowing. There's a reaction against materialism, the license, even licentiousness of colonialism, and even the idea of progress, whether through the onward march of science or the onward march of liberty, democracy and freedom, has also come under fire. So I think when you dismantle these kind of quote-unquote certainties, you know, what you uncover is a real hunger, a seeking, a feeling for, you know, there's a need to rebuild, but there's a seeking, there's a hunger, that's a very human quality. And I think part of that hunger is for the spiritual, whatever that might be. And I mentioned that this idea that, you know, in the present time, while we're busy dismantling these certainties, this intellectual structure of knowledge that we inherited from the Enlightenment, we're also in an era of globalization. And I think this is very interesting with regards to religion, because even if you shrink the scale that we're looking at from global to even the city, we're looking at societies that have become really heterogeneous ethnically, racially, they're socially mixed. And this weakens the hold of any one religion over another. It has the effect of making one faith look sectarian or one faith look parochial. And it's very hard to sustain a kind of a sense of living in history, in your time, in your community, if you're identified very strongly with something that doesn't sit easily with that. So I think in some ways the traditional faiths, you know, they have this challenge, they have a huge challenge, I think, in meeting diversity. The second point that I want to make, so this idea that you've got, the first point was about this idea that you have to flex, that faiths and spirit, both, however you conceive of these things, both of them have to flex, and they've always done so, and that's how they've survived. So I think that Jonathan's instinct to resist precise definitions or even conditions of spirituality is a very good thing. And the second thing that I wanted to talk about was that I have an experience working on a similar project that has many parallels with this, which is a joint project between ARC, which is Martin Palmer's organisation, the Alliance for Religions and Conservation, which is a joint initiative with the Club of Rome, which is a think tank that is dedicating part of this project to look for alternative stories that we tell about ourselves and our culture outside of the materialist economic culture that dominates Western thinking. And this project is called Values Quest. And it's been very interesting. It's been going for about 2 years, and it started off with a very international meeting where this idea of values was brainstormed. And people were contending. You know, they had their own values that they wanted to kind of throw into the ring and champion. And, you know, but surely justice is one of those values that everybody believes in justice. How can you argue that it's not a value that we should have and go forward with and so forth? But actually, you know, what one person experiences as justice is another person's injustice. Ditto with equality. You know, you create equal opportunities for all, and that means you, by definition, you reduce the freedom of some. So, you know, you can't have a set of values that you kind of canonise in the same way that you canonise books of the Bible or doctrine. They have the same tendency towards inflexibility. So we started thinking in this initiative, this Values Quest initiative, that it would be much more interesting to ask, to get at what people's personal values were and to see how they manifested themselves in public life. So you'd look at people in specific organisations like the UN or the World Wildlife Trust, and the idea would be to ask people what were their personal stories, why did they come to work for this organisation, what are the values that they are investing in their public life? What were the things that motivated them? What are the things they believe in? And to get them to re-engage meaningfully in what they do by having them recognise and be deeply aware of what they're investing in and what they believe in. And as we worked with this, we found that it was a very interesting things emerged, because stories are one of the things that connect people. So if somebody is explaining very powerfully why they work for a particular charity, for example, what values they have that brought them to that charity, and trying to connect those beliefs with their commitment and their work experience, then you had a very rich storytelling fabric. And we had a very real concern when we did this, and I think it's a concern for this project too, that anything more programmatic, that anything that relied on kind of propositional knowledge, quickly began to look very rigid. And we can give you an example that relates more to this context than the Values Quest context. And what comes to mind, for example, is Karen Armstrong's Compassionate Charter. I feel already, you know, this feels like something that was of its time, you know, and if we're going to move forward with the idea of working with the spirit in any kind of public domain, I just don't think that you can have something that's so definitively pinned down. So I like the idea. I like the idea that of Jonathan's injunctions. Know thyself, fear not death. This sound familiar? and the three Bs, being, becoming, and beyondness. And I think that from all our different perspectives, probably we have achieved, you know, a little bit of coalescence this evening, you know, some coming together of ideas. I wanted to make a comment about Andrew's concept of social spirituality, because I'd made a note to myself earlier about what I thought of as the essence of spirituality, or something that that I felt we strive for when we are feeling spiritual and wanting to be spiritual, and that is communion, which I think has a lot in common with this idea of social spirituality. It's a coming together, and it's a finding in togetherness of something that's greater than the sum of its parts. I don't think you have to define it very more than that, because everyone will take away something different from that. But I think that that's a valuable thing to strive for.
We've said enough for now, so I want to ask for some questions from the audience. We have one here, great.
Hello, yeah, hi, my name is Joe Heavey. There wasn't one mention of the word happiness, which I found amazing, because I think the prompting to seek the spiritual and the lack of kind of, how shall I say, rewards in totally materialistic life are kind of motivated by unhappiness. And some of the people I've met that have been involved, that are spiritual or working for other people, are extremely happy people.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. Andrew, do you think that might be for you? Do you want to take that one?
We're being deluged with propaganda for happiness and well-being at the moment, but I have to say that it seems to me to have relatively little to do with what the people up here have been saying. It's a political invention. It is an opium oven for the masses. It involves a psychological model that privileges rationality and right thinking, and many other things are wrong with it. I am very concerned indeed that everything that's going on in the spiritual world gets subsumed into these twin goods, invented goods of happiness and well-being. If I were a Buddhist, I'd feel somewhat ripped off by it, but I'm not a Buddhist, but I am a political person, and I know something dangerous when I can smell it. I don't like this.
I did mention the joyful imam at Regent's Park Mosque.
Okay, so briefly on that, the Student Design Award was part of this. We asked young people to speak, to design something, whether some sort of material or a concept or a public marketing campaign that spoke to the spiritual. And the main feedback of the judges, and I was one of them, was that they were all under 25, the people who entered, I think. They didn't really see the distinction between well-being and spirituality. So it was quite... there was one or two who won, actually, got almost there. But we thought that was quite a revelation, that actually there's something about the dominance of happiness and well-being that sort of squeezes out the spiritual that's actually not altogether good, I think. But
can
we'll come
I just say, social change, cultural change, with any meaning to it, is not going to come from happy people. It's going to come from angry, dissatisfied, questioning, resistant, and difficult people.
Hello, thank you very much. Oksana Popkova, economist, psychologist, and formerly an intellectual assassin.
Welcome.
Seeking for something else. I felt that it would be interesting to have an intellectual assassin on stage next to you, because I think you broadly agree on all your points. My question is about the dominant materialistic understanding of self and soul out there. Increasingly, technology companies are paying more and more attention about creation of artificial intelligence. And I sense the philosophical underpinning there is the moment they are able to create a thinking, a feeling machine, they will figure themselves out. They will understand themselves. It's an alternative approach. I would like your comment to that approach to soul and spirituality.
Okay, since that was my framework, let me just say this. Technology is very important. We didn't say much about it, but it clearly is a huge part of our world. So whatever the spiritual is, it has to have some kind of relationship to technology. Jaron Lanier is quite good on this, that we have to, how we structure the internet, how we interact with social media, has to keep the spiritual in mind. And that means that we need to sort of think more deeply about what is the kind of engine of growth within these mechanisms. So if everyone controls, if information and knowledge and power are increasingly the same thing as they are, then one of the ways that information, knowledge, and power is wielded is through the self, actually, because people are getting data on the self, and they're presenting themselves as a form of personal curation and interaction. And the self is becoming the thing that we present to the world, but also the thing that's used to sell us goods. So there is a real danger that if we don't get a sort of proper relationship to the self and a richer understanding of the soul, then actually we will be bombarded with things that we are tailor-made for us to be taken by us, shaping us in certain ways, not necessarily for our own agenda, but for someone else's. So the lady in the green scarf, thanks.
Angela Harvey. Andrew, you said towards the end that there was no spirituality in politicians. And something close to that, something about that. And I was trying to understand, Andrew, if that was what you said, whether you felt that we needed new politicians who had spirituality, or whether there had to be a way of getting spirituality into politicians.
For me, what's important is that this is that we do what we're talking about via ordinary people, and in that sense, I welcome politicians into it. I don't join in the demonizing of the individuals who become politicians. If I demonize anybody, it is the self-declared spiritual people. They're the problem from spirituality's point of view.
They do have spirituality. They're human beings, I haven't seen.
The other thing to say there about spirituality as a status claim is quite important. In about 2 years of doing this project, I felt this quite acutely, that there is a real danger of self-declared spirituality as a kind of barrier, that my spirituality is X, and who are you to interfere with it? And as, you know, you can call something spirituality and then rustle in a lot of other agendas under that guise. So there is, on the one hand, we can't take complete ownership of the term. It has to flex and evolve. It is inclusively ambiguous by its nature. On the other hand, you have to guard against that being just used as a free-for-all for anyone's agenda. So that's part of the cultural challenge, is how to navigate those sort of tensions.
Jonathan, you were saying at the beginning that part of this project was about finding some way to talk about spirituality to people who aren't comfortable with speaking about it, and to find some way of intellectually grounding it. And then Marina, I think towards the end, what I was getting from what you were saying was that often these attempts to ground it end up making it inflexible. And how do you deal with that tension between those two problems?
Marina.
I'm not sure how you deal. I think what you need to do is you need to have spirituality constantly in the mix. So you have to have somebody constantly standing up for it. Wherever you have a kind of a meeting of different people around a table, there must always be somebody there. It mustn't always be banished to the sidelines and be deemed irrelevant. So, no, we're talking about economics here. What has spirituality got to tell us? Well, actually, a great deal. You know, I'm not saying I would run a mile if a politician stood up and said, "Now, I'm a really deeply spiritual being, and this is why I'm going to give this policy, recommend this policy." That's not what I want to hear. But I want to have consultation, and I want to have depthful soul searching. And I think that people are fed up with easy answers, and they're fed up with being told what to do. And I know best mentality. And I think that people, you know, we're living in very shifting times, which I think is a great privilege, actually, and to harness some of that energy that arrives with change and have spirituality kind of take its place at the table, I think, is what you want.
So for me, it's about what are permissible conversations in public. So when you watch something like Question Time, I just use that because it's kind of iconic. There are certain things that are sort of allowed to be said in mainstream, and certain things that seem just deviant and almost transgressive or subversive. And I'd like to see more of those things that are transgressive and subversive said. So that there was one moment where I mentioned the Scottish referendum. There was one moment a few months back when Leslie Riddick, who was a main campaigner for the Yes campaign, was asked, you know, won't you just accept the result now? You know, it's clearly done and dusted. And she said, well, this was the best year of my life. And it was very rare to hear an answer like that. She said, it was the best year of my life. There was so much camaraderie. I felt I knew what I was doing. I connected deeply with people. And although, yes, the result is done and dusted, I can't say whatever it was that gave me that, I'm not going to forsake that. I want more of it. And it was the kind of answer that really thought, why don't we hear this more often? You know, someone is actually speaking to us from the heart. So for me, the answer is not so much explicitly spiritual, but speaking of things in a way that are deeper and truer and that are not currently permissible. All right. One more question and we'll round up. Yeah.
I've actually got three questions from Twitter.
Okay, of course.
Gotta take them. Okay, so for Professor Samuels, is social spirituality a new incarnation of the good, the true, and the beautiful?
Hold that.
For Claire, do you believe that mystics of other traditions access divine truth? And if so, is that a problem for Christianity?
Okay, we'll grab that. Good question for tonight.
And the final one, which is quite to wrap it up, actually. Spirituality means so much. Is there a way to explain what spirituality means in one sentence? A pithy one-liner.
Not really.
For me, none of this is about the good, the true, and the beautiful. It's all much more jagged and dangerous than that. I mean, the marriage of politics and spirituality is like a marriage between two very disturbed and deeply unpleasant individuals with no sign of a couples therapist at all.
Okay, on that cheery note. So listen, one of the best lines in this project was from, I first heard it from Chris Harding. He said that we don't think ourselves into new ways of acting, we act ourselves into new ways of thinking. So with that in mind, we normally end this event in a particular way, but instead of that, I want you to briefly introduce yourself to the person sitting next to you, or reintroduce yourself before you go. So take that chance now, please, just to say hello to who you're sitting next to, so that you've shared this together, and this will be with you again. So if you take the chance just to say hello, if you already know each other, just so that when you leave tonight, you don't leave as an isolated atom, but a bit more like a molecule. That's it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And thanks very much for coming, and good night.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.